welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are once again looking at Alfred Hitchcock, this time with his 1959 classic, North by Northwest. Returning on the show today to talk about North by Northwest is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back.
So this film probably defines Hitchcock for me even more than something like, you know, Psycho or Rear Window. It's just everything you would expect in a Hitchcock movie is in this one. You kind of have the story of a, you know, mistaken identity, the wrong man being accused of the crime. He's got to go on the run. You've got the prototypical Hitchcock blonde that he sort of falls in love with. It helps him along the way.
Falling from a great height.
You kind of have the MacGuffin that, you know, is absolutely non-essential in this movie, but it just pushes the plot forward enough.
Using a national monument mm-hmm. as a backdrop, the brandy that they get Cary Grant drunk with.
Mm-hmm. Just everything is in this movie that you'd expect in Hitchcock.
Mother issues.
It's everything. It's like if some person had never seen a Hitchcock movie before. And they had to watch one movie, and that only could watch one just to fully get who he is. I would make them watch this one.
Yeah, and it also has the best cameo right in the mm-hmm. intro too.
Yeah, just everything's in here.
It has a Saul Bass intro. It's got Bernard Herrmann music. Mm-hmm. It really is the quintessential Hitchcock movie.
And what's interesting about this film, this is the first time I've seen this since I watched another movie he did called The 39 Steps. Mm-hmm. And when I watched The 39 Steps for the first time, I felt, wow, this is a lot like North by Northwest. And then when I watched North by Northwest, like, wow, this is a lot like The 39 Steps. And I know he's no stranger to remaking his own stuff. He obviously remade The Man Who Knew Too Much because he did that in 1934 with Peter Lorre. So even though this isn't a direct remake, it feels almost like he's remaking that film into a little bit different. Because like in that film, a guy accused of a murder he didn't commit. There's a Hitchcock blonde that helps mm-hmm. him along the way. There's like this spy agency that's kind of after him. There's some sort of secrets or something that spy agency is selling. We don't really know, but it's just enough to get the plot going. It's very similar.
Yeah, and the theater backdrop, although that's not like North by Northwest, but it's a Hitchcock mm-hmm. technique. Yeah, I think probably he liked what happened in the 39 Steps and thought, how can we work with that again?
Yeah, and this isn't a remake. It was actually an interesting story. I was reading it behind his creation. I read that he came up with the idea almost like 9 years before the movie came out, and it was sort of just something that came to him during about a writer's block.
Well, what do you know about the story? Just that much?
Just that much. I was wondering if you had anything else to...
You know, I know that he was excited about the project and made the mistake of discussing with Jimmy Stewart, who then really wanted to be in it. And Hitchcock didn't want him to be in it because he blamed... Stewart for the flop of Vertigo at the box office because he thought Stewart looked too old. Hmm. Ironically, Cary Grant is only is 4 years older than
than
Jimmy Stewart. So, and he's too close in age to the woman who's playing his mother, but somehow it all works because it's Cary Grant.
It's like in Manchurian Candidate when Angela Lansbury is supposed to be the mom, but she's only a few years older than her son. And you say that Stewart wanted to be in it because I couldn't imagine anybody else but Cary Grant in this movie because he brings a lot of the humor into the movie. You know, he's very, he's being accused of murder, he's on the run, he still always has that humor and wit about him, like a Cary Grant, like something yep. you would see in His Girl Friday or something.
Always charming.
Yeah.
In fact, his suit in that movie is iconic.
I've read about it, yeah.
There's actually a short story written from the viewpoint of the suit. Of the plot of North
really?
By Northwest. Yes, yes. And it's called Cary Grant's Suit. You know, which I think is just really awesome. I think that is terrific.
And I couldn't, like, just thinking, like, if James Stewart was in this movie, it just wouldn't have worked, I think.
No, I think James Stewart is a little bit too laconic and laid back. You need somebody who has that sort of goofball.
Yeah, he doesn't have
He doesn't do goofball.
He doesn't have that wit that Cary Grant has. And it just wouldn't come off as good.
Yeah, no, it has to be Cary Grant. It has mm-hmm. to sort of be, you know, I know you're going to get to this question, but they call it the first Bond movie.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
And Cary Grant kind of embodies that sort of, you know, he always looks great. Mm-hmm. You know, you put a drink in his hand and suddenly he's the most interesting man in the room. It's, you know, he is kind of James Bond.
Yeah, and actually, I'll just dive right into that now, because a lot of people do consider this as the first James Bond movie, and is definitely, maybe not so much the Daniel Craig's, but definitely feels a lot like the Connery ones. We got the, you know, the megalomaniacal villain, you know, he's got the British accent, that always helps. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the Bond girl, the Hitchcock blonde, kind of go together. She helps, you know, he seduces her, and then she helps him along the way. And of course, you know, Grant is a lot like Connery. He's always got a drink in his hand, you know, martinis, chicken not stirred.
He looks like he knows how to dance.
Yep, and he's always got this wit, and he's always got time for a funny little remark, even though there's always something going down.
Now, interestingly, there are a whole bunch of people who were considered for the Roger Thornhill role, and let me see what you think of these people as, you know, like a Bond hero as opposed to Cary Grant. One was Gregory Peck, who Hitchcock did not want because he thought he was stone-faced, which I think is interesting because, you know, he did work with him in two other movies, Paradigm Case and Spellbound.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he knew what he was capable of doing. Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin.
Yeah, Sinatra and Martin, I don't know. Like, they're not really, like, yeah, just not quite what I would expect in a Bond guy.
And finally, William Holden. Who I think could have looked the part, but I don't think he has, I don't know, that sort of rakish charm that Cary Grant has.
Yeah, Holden's always been more of like a tough guy or a sleazy guy.
Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard, yeah. Once again, kind of adding to that sleaziness.
Right, yeah, sort of he could have played a villain, I think.
Definitely. Yeah, it was just Cary Grant, and then probably, I said this earlier, probably the most iconic of all of the Hitchcock blondes is Eva Marie Saint. And, you know, obviously she has the blonde hair, but she kind of has this coldness about her throughout the movie because you think, keep thinking, whose side is she really on, you know? Because first she does this, then you think she kills Cary Grant, then she doesn't. And, then, you know, it's very much like in the line of like a Grace Kelly or a Kim Novak.
Well, it's interesting you say Grace Kelly because there was a whole bunch of people considered for this role, one of them being Grace Kelly. And Hitchcock, of course, wanted Grace Kelly. He was also interested in, Cary Grant was interested in it being Sophia Loren. Mm-hmm. Sid Charisse was also considered. And Elizabeth Taylor and Vera Miles.
Oh, yeah, Vera Miles.
Now, Vera Miles is in other Hitchcock movies, and she kind of has that Eva Marie Saint look. You know, I think she could have pulled it off. But of those actresses, who would you have chosen if Eva Marie Saint had turned it down?
I probably would have chosen Grace Kelly just because she's done mm-hmm. a lot of good work with Hitchcock before.
And with Cary Grant.
Mm-hmm. Was this during the time she got married to that prince and she had to retire?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's probably why he didn't choose her.
Right.
Okay.
I think he would have if he could have. She was already Princess of Monaco at that time.
And then we got to get to the villain played by James Mason and... You know, very, like, I think of the most Bondish elements of this movie, it's definitely him because he's got the British accent. He's got the he's got the villain's lair out of, in the middle of nowhere where nobody else is. He's trying to sell nuclear secrets. You don't really know what he's doing, but you know it's sinister. And he's probably the most, like, it almost seems like he's like a Dr. Evil from the Bond movies, you know?
You know, he's such a great character actor. Because he kind of carries his role no matter whatever he's playing. You always remember him.
Even in something like another film I know him from is Lolita.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, you haven't? That's a good one. I recommend it.
Is it? Maybe we'll have to do that one at some other some other time.
And then one of the early one of her breakout performances, speaking of spy stuff, is also Martin Landau.
Yes.
In this movie, who obviously just in a few years later would work on the Mission Impossible show.
You know, there's a lot of people in this movie who went on to do spy stuff. There are two actors who went on to head spy agencies in their own 1960s TV series. Edward Platt would star as Chief in Get Smart. Leo Carroll as Mr. Waverly in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and its spinoff, The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. And Martin Landau would work as a spy in Mission Impossible. So that's another reason why people mm-hmm. might think of this as the first Bond movie because it spawned so many spy
Yeah.
Roles.
It almost feels like it may be like the first Cold War spy movie. Just even if it, like you said, not only just a Bond movie, but a Mission Impossible or a Man from U.N.C.L.E., all those TV shows, or even in a certain sense, Austin Powers. Well, you know, why not?
Oh, yes. You know? Well, you know, the funny thing I think about Austin Powers is, to me, he's clearly mugging Cary Grant. He's mm-hmm. trying to do Cary Grant.
Yeah, a bit of Cary Grant, and obviously Sean Connery, I think. Especially with the ridiculous amount of chest hair.
Yes, and a down market version of both of those guys as well.
Yeah, and another thing I think probably I forgot about what makes this a Hitchcock movie is the score by Bernard Herrmann. And they've done quite a few films together, but if I had to just choose one, even more than like I probably would say maybe Vertigo more, just slightly more. But second, this one, I think it's. I just love that opening sequence with the music. Like, that's such a great opening.
It is, and it gives you a sense of foreboding. Mm-hmm. It immediately sets the stage, and it works so well with the graphics kind of coming in at different angles that look sort of like the buildings, all Saul Bass. Terrific intro. And then, of course, it ends with directed by Alfred Hitchcock, just as he's missing the bus mm-hmm. and the cameo.
Perfect.
So really, really terrific intro.
And then even I like when they use it more when they're trying to set him up for a drunk driving death.
Yes.
And then they got that same music playing, and then the camera's going all over the place because he's drunk and he's trying to take control of the wheel and he keeps trying to avoid cars. That's another great part.
Yes. It also looks like they borrowed some of that footage from Suspicion with the the cliff.
Oh, and, yeah.
And clearly it's done in a studio. In fact, lots of things in this movie were done in a studio. They did the crop dusting scene. Cary Grant actually, when he dives, he's actually diving into something in the studio, okay. And they cut everything together. But that crop dusting scene is probably one of the most famous scenes ever.
Yeah, I mean, just even before I've seen this movie, I've seen that scene. I think it's just, it's one of the like classic iconic scenes, just I think in any movie, one of the most, just because... It's very unexpected. You think like even if somebody was going to try to kill him, you think somebody would be sniping at him or just come up and just shoot him or like, you know, hey, let's go over here. And you don't expect that plane to be coming, but it sets it up perfectly when the one guy goes, you know, that's funny. That plane's dusting crops where there aren't any crops. And then you start to realize something's going on. And then it's just such a class in like that. The classic shot you keep on seeing when it's coming at him and he's running away from it. Yeah,
just... his tie is flying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great scene. I mean, being chased by a plane. Talk about the ultimate huge bird to get another of Hitchcock's favorite things in there. Now, one thing he wanted to do, he had planned to shoot in the Ford plant in Dearborn, Michigan.
Oh.
He wanted Thornhill to open the passenger door and out would roll the body of the foreman he had just been discussing with somebody else. Hitchcock loved this idea of a body appearing out of nowhere, but the screenwriter couldn't figure out how to make that fit into the story. So, but that would have been very Hitchcock, mm-hmm. a body appearing out of nowhere.
Yeah, and like you said, the studios, like the studio sets, like it's very impressive just because I couldn't, like the house and near Mount Rushmore, like I thought that was just some house they shot at, because I thought, but it's like, it's designed in a studio. They made it look like a real house, and remember, they wanted to make it look specifically like a Frank Lloyd Wright house.
Yeah, and they imported like 100 ponderosa pines to make that.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, if you ever go to Mount Rushmore, you see there it's not like that. You can't, you know, creep up on the monument from Frank Lloyd Wright's house. And Hitchcock actually wanted to call the movie The Man in Lincoln's Nostril. And he wanted Cary Grant to get in there and sneeze. But the people, somebody talked him out of it and said, well, how would you feel about, you know, if it was the other way around? And he said, okay, well, he still wanted to use that title, though. That would have been, I think, a little too goofy.
Just a bit.
Even for Hitchcock.
But you talk about goofiness. This is probably with the exception of The Trouble with Harry, which is probably his biggest comedy. I know he did another one called Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I haven't seen.
It's not very good.
Not very good. But I know that was like not even a Hitchcock movie. It was a screwball comedy.
Yeah. It feels like a B movie, too. It doesn't really work, even though it's got Carol Lombard in it. You would think it would be good.
Yeah, but with the exception of maybe those two movies, which are straight-up comedies, this is probably the most humor I've seen in a Hitchcock movie. It's almost like – this is almost like a comedy. You could definitely say it just because one of the funniest lines early on in the movie is when he's talking with his secretary and he sees the watchman and he goes, oh, hello. Say hello to the missus for me. He goes, we don't talk anymore.
Catskills humor, yeah. Right? Take my wife, please. One line that I really like in the movie is where Cary Grant says, I don't like the way Teddy Roosevelt is looking at me because it reminds me of his role in Arsenic and Old Lace, where he has that relative who's, you know, always doing the Teddy Roosevelt thing. So, you know, when you hear the line, you know, you remember the other movie, it brings that humor to this one.
Yeah, and just one of the funnier lines is when he gets out of the house and they get into the car and he goes, imagine me, the maid held me hostage for 5 minutes until I realized she had your silly gun in her hand. I just cracked up with that one too. There's just a lot, just every little bit of that humor, even like the mother character, even though she's kind of like the Norma Bates mom, and like the very, you know, like a lot of Hitchcock moms, she still had a lot of funny events. Like she keeps, you know, she just doesn't believe her son anyway. She just thinks, you know, just, you're drunk, admit it.
I like the line where she says, you know, just pay the $2, because that goes back to an old vaudeville joke where a guy is, his lawyer is defending him and he keeps getting the sentence increased. And all he had to do in the beginning was to pay $2. So eventually, you know, just pay the $2. She gets a chance to have a few good lines, which sets her apart from, you know, the typical Hitchcock mother.
Yeah, the line is, you know, you men aren't really trying to kill my son, are you?
Oh, there's also those scenes in the UN, and Hitchcock couldn't get permission to film inside the UN, so they made footage of the exterior of the building using a hidden camera, and then the rooms were later created on a soundstage. I wonder if you could do that today.
Film at the UN?
Well, even to film the exterior and then try to make a... I wonder if somebody would give you a hard time about that, given how, you know, you're not supposed to have cameras on you when you're going through customs or...
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if there would be a problem with that today.
And speaking of the UN, one of the shots I really liked, I'm pretty sure was... It's the overhead shot from way above as he's escaping the UN. And I think, was that like a design or a set or something?
I'm not sure how they did that one.
Yeah, because I didn't know how they did that.
That was a cool shot. Now, you know, the whole script was very confusing for Cary Grant. He didn't know what was going on. And he kept saying, I don't see how this is going to work because this makes no sense. And Hitchcock thought that was good because his character is confused. Mm-hmm. So I think that's that perfect. Actually works to his advantage in the movie.
Yeah. And going back a little bit to the humor, another good part of the humor at the movie is sort of a bit of the editing by George Tomasini, who also worked with Hitchcock on in Psycho and the famous shower sequence. And one of the things that the funniest just little suggestive parts at the end is, well, the first part is like you think it's this tense end when she's hanging on the Mount Rushmore. And he grabs her, and it's that you don't know if she's going to survive. Then he has got this smile on her face, and it's a match cut where they're on their honeymoon, and they're on the train stop. And then, like, the next cut, when they're kissing, it goes into a train going into a tunnel. Just, we all know what that means, and it's funny he gets away with it.
You know, I don't know if I can say this on the air, but you'll edit it out if we can't. But Alfred Hitchcock actually came up with that innuendo. He considered it one of his finest, naughtiest achievements. And Ernest Lehman's screenplay descended with the train heads off in the distance or words like that. So there's no way I can take credit for the tunnel, Lehman said, adding, damn it.
And just, I think one of the biggest uses of this is like maybe besides even the money in Psycho or even what was in the bottle in Notorious, you got another classic use of a MacGuffin in this film, which... What's in the film in that little doll thing?
Right. What is it?
Yeah. We don't know. And like even just what James Mason character actually does, it sort of vaguely says he sells secrets. Like what kind of secrets? He just says, well, imports, exports, you know, like what does that mean? But it's funny because that's not really the point of the movie.
I think imports, exports is this movie's plastics. It's one of those things that you say and it covers so much. It
covers so much.
Like, that could be anything, imports, exports. But that does, if you're a spy, sound like you're actually working both sides of the fence.
Let's see. And looking more about this movie, I was surprised that this has to be one of the biggest snubs in, I think, in Oscar history. Because it only got 3 nominations, and it's kind of like art direction, nothing like really heavy, like Best Picture, Best Actor. It got
Best Director.
Yeah. Very few nominations and no wins. And I'm just like, I know 59 Ben-Hur also came out, and that's when won Best Picture, and Ben-Hur's a classic, I'm not saying it isn't. But come on, North by Northwest, like you couldn't even like give it a lot of nominations? I'm like, why? Like, how, I just, baffles me.
Especially since today it's still stylish. Mm-hmm. It's still different than everything else you've seen. And it's unlike a true James Bond movie, it does have those funny moments. It's got everything.
Everything. And just like how, and like not even the best director nominations, considering this is one of his all-time great movies. I'm thinking just, it's just, it's sort of like when you look at, like, you figure out, like, Stanley Kubrick's never won anything as an Oscar. You're just like, what are they missing? Well,
yeah, Stanley Kubrick was such a maverick, though, that I think they probably snubbed him for that. But Hitchcock, this is so commercial.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think this is on the list of most people's favorite films and certainly their favorite Hitchcock film.
Mm-hmm. I've been looking at it, Hitchcock. I know he's only one of his films has won Best Picture, and it was the very first film he ever did in America, Rebecca. And I don't think he technically, that's an Oscar win for him, because I think that's given to the producer. So he's never won an Oscar in his entire career, which I just find baffling.
I know, that is, it is bizarre. It is bizarre. But mm-hmm. I think he was considered sort of a populist, like a guy who made movies for the general public rather than an artiste. And I think it's only now that we sort of recognize the artistry in what he did.
And it's too late now.
It's too late now. Yeah. It's always, that always happens, yeah. Doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But if I was going to pick one of Hitchcock's movies to retroactively go back in time and give it Best Picture, this would be the one.
Even more so than Vertigo?
Yeah, because I think Vertigo has some problems. And this isn't even my favorite Hitchcock, which is Rear Window.
Me too.
But just as a technical achievement, I think this one has it all.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, a little bit of put you on the spot here. For it was 59, so do you think this is better than Ben-Hur?
Oh, yes, I do.
Me too.
I mean, Ben-Hur is a good movie, but I think this stands the test of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw the remake of Ben-Hur, which was actually really exciting.
Really?
Ben-Hur is all about the chariot race. And, you know, with special effects and 3D, you can really make a chariot race come off the screen at you, if that's what you want the movie to be. And I think just as a technical achievement and feeling like you're in it, it kind of refreshed Ben-Hur. So if you go back and look at the original now, it seems not as thrilling as it probably was in 59. And a movie like North by Northwest definitely eclipses it now.
So you actually recommend the Ben-Hur remake?
Oh, not to I don't think it's a shining bit of cinematic achievement, okay. But it is definitely worth watching for the chariot race.
Okay. Wow.
And tell me what you think after you've seen it.
You're going to make me watch the remake.
Well, you could probably just find that clip on YouTube.
I'll find the clip on YouTube. Let's see. Oh, now I got to bring up one of the most famous, I'm not sure if this is, but is this one of the most famous bloopers of all time in movies? Where it's the visitor, they're at the visitor center, and she's about to pull the gun on and shoot him. But even before she gets the gun out, you see the one kid plugging his ears, and you're like, wow, that is one really perceptive kid.
You know, I think, though, leaving that in is sort of Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. Because it's funny. Because we notice that, oh, wait, nothing's even happened yet. And they could have edited it out, but they didn't. It reminds me of Rear Window, where Hitchcock shows you, the audience, things that Jimmy Stewart doesn't see. So you have more information than he does. So I think it's kind of an in-joke between Hitchcock and the audience. What do you think? Do you think it's really a mistake?
You might have just left it in there and thought it'd be funny, yeah. And, Hitchcock would have that kind of sense of humor anyway.
It also, to me, was just the quintessential, and there's the bratty kid ruining the vacation shot. And Hitchcock loved to do that kind of thing. It sort of reminds me of the kid in Blackmail who's pestering him on the train,
or even the kid in the Man Who Knew Too Much, who gets kidnapped and starts all this trouble,
or the kid at the fairground in Strangers on a train.
Yeah,
I guess he has a bratty kid motif. Mm-hmm.
Maybe Hitchcock didn't like children.
You know what he said? He didn't. He thought they were very sticky.
It's like W.C. Fields.
You know, what's funny, though, is the interviews that they have with his granddaughters, he was apparently just a wonderful, open, loving person. Loved his family and spent a lot of time with them and a real family man.
Hmm. Okay. Let's see. And so can we talk a little bit more about some Hitchcock stuff. Did you watch any – last month they did a whole kind of marathon stuff on Turner Classic. Did you have a chance to catch any of that?
I didn't. Did you?
Yeah, and they were the guy they had on there, because Ben Mankiewicz is the host now, and he was interviewing a guy who did it. He's done a new documentary. It's called 7852. He's dissecting, I think it's the 78 edits and 52 shots in the shower sequence in Psycho.
Oh, cool.
And he's just talking about it. And I think it premiered at Sundance earlier this year, and I guess it's gotten really good reviews. So that's something I would have to check out.
Me too. I can't wait to see that.
And the guy, he's very knowledgeable, because he talked a lot about Hitchcock. Even like when they were talking about his earlier films, he talked about his relationship with David O. Selznick. And he seems very knowledgeable, so that's something I would definitely like to check out.
By the way, there is a David O. Selznick reference in North by Northwest, in that Roger Thornhill's name is actually Roger O. Thornhill, and he claims that the O stands for nothing, which is a reference to Selznick, whose O also signified nothing.
He didn't really like that guy, did he?
No, he got those little digs in. So it also, there's another Hitchcock thing. He gets a dig into Selznick.
Yeah.
Obliquely.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I forgot to bring up? Oh, one thing I do want to talk about is the Saul Bass title sequence we talked a little bit about, but I don't think he quite gets enough credit for his work with Hitchcock. I mean, he's done a hell of a lot more. I know one example, he worked on the poster for The Shining, but he's one of the great like graphic designers in history, because I took one graphic design class in college, and that was one of the people we learned about.
Me too, and I've always been impressed by the way he puts together those intros. Psycho's very cool, you know, and very minimalist, but it gets that across, gets the idea across really well.
Especially with the music, just like in this movie where it's the dun, dun, it feels like a stabbing sequence, you know
it
what's
does.
Going on.
It does, or a screaming sequence.
Which, now, was it him that also did the opening title sequence for Goodfellas, or was that Scorsese making an homage to Psycho?
I'm not sure.
Because in Goodfellas, it's the, you know, you hear the cars going along, and it's the title cards sounding like they're, you know, looking like cars driving. I always wondered if that was Saul Bass.
You know, if not, it was definitely inspired by it. That's very Saul Bass-esque. Now, one question I have for you is, the one problem I have with this movie showing it in the classroom is that it's kind of long.
It is, yeah, it is pretty long. So would you feel that there's something they could have cut out?
What would you cut?
Maybe, like, some of the parts later on when he's getting taken into the station, maybe, just because, like, we get it a little bit, he's drunk, maybe. But I don't know, like, it adds the humor in the film. So.
Yeah, I don't know that I would cut anything either, but it makes it a problem to show in the class, because it takes up so much of the class, you don't have even much time to set it up.
Okay, then. So last question I'll have is, just tell us a little bit about what you got going on for the fall semester.
Well, in fall, I am going to be teaching the films of Alfred Hitchcock online. So the entire class is online, which means all of the movies are streamed online and the assignments, everything is online. And it goes a little bit beyond Hitchcock in that one of the movies we are going to talk about, of course, is Strangers on a Train. And you can read the book to go with it. And I'm including the movie Carol, and the Talented Mr. Ripley. So if you're interested in Patricia Highsmith, you can go through the Hitchcock door to get there.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Alfred Hitchcock and his 1959 classic, North by Northwest. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, that's funny, that plane's dusting crops where there ain't no crops.